From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, a new report shows how the Midwest still has stark inequalities when it comes to race and opportunity. Then, writer Steve Hanna still takes to heart the words his editor-in-chief at the Milwaukee Journal told him when he first moved here from the East Coast.
Sig ushered me into his office and said, "I want you to remember one thing, young man from New Jersey. Wisconsin is not just a state. Wisconsin is a state of mind."
And poet Greg Shapiro says while people and places are a big influence for his work, he never writes poetry for himself.
If I'm writing a poem about an experience, I'm hoping that someone can learn something from it or someone can relate to it. There's a commonality, a universal voice. Even if you're straight and you're reading it, I'm hoping that there's something that you can connect to.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. According to a recent report, Race in the Heartland, Equity, Opportunity, and Public Policy in the Midwest, all 12 states in the region have obvious racial disparities between its black and white populations. The report compares Midwestern states to other parts of the country in areas like education, employment, health, and home ownership. WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell spoke with the report's lead author, Colin Gordon. He's a professor of history at the University of Iowa and a research consultant for the Iowa Policy Project. He explains that in order to understand our current racial inequalities, we have to understand what happened in the past. Powell wanted to know why the Midwest still has such stark inequalities.
I think the answer to that question is an historical one, in the sense that, you know, the history of African Americans in the Midwest is really bound up with the Great Migration north in the middle years of the last century for what was then a sort of industrial boom in what we now call Rust Belt cities. So, but what that resulted in and what we, you know, are experiencing today is a very sort of stark two-tiered system of segregation. So the vast majority of African Americans in the Midwest live in just 50 or 60 metropolitan counties. That is, they're concentrated in the metropolitan regions. So in much of the rural Midwest, African Americans are, you know, essentially, in one sense, sort of invisible in public policy discussions, but also hyper-visible in settings like schools and employment and that sort of thing. And then where African Americans do live, they encountered and continue to encounter a very stark and systematic architecture of residential segregation in cities like Milwaukee, Madison, Des Moines, Minneapolis, St. Louis.
I like that you mentioned a word I pulled out as sort of a key in this, and that is that these issues are systemic. Probably one of the most important takeaways for me. But it also made me think about how a lot of people might not consider how powerful systemic racism is.
Yeah, I think, as you say, it is important to root this in historical practices of segregation. Because if we approach it simply as a problem of prejudice or discrimination, then presumably it's just a matter of convincing people to act otherwise or enforcing our civil rights laws. But if we consider the impact of segregation and the lasting impact of segregation on household wealth, on economic opportunity, on neighborhoods, on school quality, all of those are still very much with us and create neighborhood concentrations of disadvantage that are still just as powerful as they were half a century ago.
So in looking at the impact of segregation on education, for example, the report focused on measures of achievement, exclusion, and attainment. And just looking at achievement, you guys compared eighth grade math test scores in 41 states in 2017. 10 Midwestern states ranked in the bottom half of that distribution as far as having the widest gaps in black and white students' test scores. And 4, Wisconsin, North Dakota, Minnesota, and Ohio, hold the absolute bottom spots. Why is this information important to look at?
Well, it's an important starting point. One way to think about the range of disparities that we look at across the report is to think about across a person's own life course. And so we're always very concerned with what might be characterized as starting gate equality, that, you know, what do we provide for our children? And it's a, you know, it's a particularly powerful argument, I think, because you strip away, you know, we have a lot of arguments about what we do to support adults, for example, that's a politically contentious issue. You know, you have to work, you aren't deserving of state assistance, that sort of thing. But those arguments fall away when we're talking about kids who are blameless, who deserve an equal opportunity. And so we start with education, and the disparities that you'd notice, the math scores, the suspensions, are really just markers for educational outcomes, for educational opportunities and exclusion, and for outcomes at a higher level of education as well when we look at college attainment. And that's clearly a consequence of this longstanding pattern of residential segregation, because residential segregation not only sort of sorts the population by race and class in a given metropolitan setting, but it sorts resources and tax revenue and the capacity to fund schools as well. So what you find is in, you know, most of the older Rust Belt cities, the African-American neighborhoods that we look at, that's where there's a sort of sustained fiscal crisis in terms of the ability to pay for schools, to maintain good schools, and to provide that sort of essential starting gate equality.
What I think is great about this report is that it's not just laying out the problems, it's also giving potential solutions. And so it outlines what kind of policy changes could be done that could begin to close some of these disparities. So what would you say is one sort of small thing and one big thing that could be done in the Midwest that would really get at addressing these disparities, and who needs to do it?
Those are good questions. I mean, I think a small thing that would be quite impactful is make a serious effort at the state and local level to equalizing education funding, to not allow schools with wealthier property tax bases to hoard opportunities that really belong to all our children. Mm-hmm. And that is actually sort of relatively easy to do. It's a redistribution of resources that would take much more seriously the advantages and the disadvantages faced by particular districts and particular schools. That can be, I think, accompanied by much closer attention to racial equity in-school policies. So some settings in the Midwest, I think Madison is a good example of this, have made some progress in recent years in closing the suspension gap, in minimizing the number of suspensions overall, in order to close that disparity in sort of basic educational opportunity, and, you know, and its implications for a sort of school to prison pipeline. So those sorts of changes would not cost a lot of money. It's sort of moving around the money that we have, and simply call for, you know, greater attention to equity on local policies, even in school policies. The big task to tackle, I think, is reinvest in neighborhoods of concentrated poverty, particularly in metropolitan settings. We do know that when a family has an opportunity to leave a neighborhood of concentrated poverty and settle in a mixed income neighborhood, that the results are dramatic for their children, especially when the children are younger. So the earlier in life, that has a huge impact. But it's unrealistic to think that we can do that for all families. So we have to seriously consider reinvesting in those neighborhoods. And part of that reinvestment is in schools, in ensuring that sort of baseline educational opportunity. But it also means investments in things that make, you know, a productive and healthy life possible. Recreation, healthy food, you know, addressing the problem of food deserts in our cities. And all of these, again, can be accomplished with relatively small investments and small changes in the way in which we practice economic development, the way in which we zone land use, and things like that.
Who would you say this report is for?
Well, the state policy groups that I'm involved with, we're trying to accomplish a couple of things. One is just to educate the general public about the problems that we face and the solutions that might help. But also we want to reach those who are in a position to make a difference. And by this, I mean not just state legislators, although they're important, but also advocacy organizations, people who have been doing, have had their shoulder to this wheel for a long time. We see our role as providing, some sort of empirical support for their efforts.
And for those who will come across this report in the future, what do you hope they take away from it?
I mean, the final piece that I would emphasize with regard to policy is that we sort of frame our policy recommendations around sort of two big ideas, one of which is universalism. That is, policies that are not targeted at any particular people, but sort of lift up the floor for everybody. And the most disadvantaged among us will always benefit the most from something like a higher minimum wage, more school funding, that sort of thing. So we advocate a set of sort of higher universal standards. But secondly, we recognize that given the historical scale of the damage, that we also need to target, and that means targeting specific populations and also targeting specific places. In recognition of the historical disadvantages that some people and some places face.
Colin Gordon is a professor of history at the University of Iowa and a research consultant for the Iowa Policy Project. He spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, about the new report, Race in the Heartland, Equity, Opportunity, and Public Policy in the Midwest. You can find a link to the full report at WUWM.com. After a break, we'll talk with the former managing editor of the Milwaukee Journal, Steve Hanna, about his new book about Wisconsin, Dairylandia, Dispatches from a State of Mind. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Steve Hanna had no intention of living in Wisconsin, but life and love had other plans, and thanks to a chance detour many years ago, the New Jersey native found himself in the Dairy State. He's never really left. Hanna is a former managing editor for the Milwaukee Journal, and he was the CEO of The Onion for more than a decade. But one of his longest-running columns was once called State of Mind, and in it, Hanna documented the funny, the weird, and the poignant across his adopted state. Those columns have been turned into a book-long love letter to Wisconsin. Dairylandia, Dispatches from a State of Mind, came out earlier this fall, and Lake Effect's Bonnie North reached Hanna at his home in Madison to learn more.
Steve Hanna, it is a pleasure to have you on Lake Effect. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And as I said before we were on the air, I get a little homesick for Wisconsin in winter because I spend part of it down in Texas, and I listen to WUWM on, I just tell Alexa, put on WUWM Lake Effect, and she occasionally does what I say.
Well, see, when she does it next time, you can say, play my interview.
I don't know that I'll be able to bear that.
Can't listen to yourself.
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, it's like reading your own work. It's hearing your own voice. And speaking of reading your own work, I loved Dairylandia.
Thank you.
It is such a delightful, basically, it's like a travel guide through Wisconsin. And the thing that struck me the most was how much you love this state.
Yeah, well, you have to fall in love with someone or some place, and when it comes to some place, if you grow up in the most congested state in the Union, which is New Jersey, and particularly in the part that I grew up in, in the shadow of the Empire State Building.
I was going to say, you're in northern New Jersey, right?
I'm in northern Jersey, right across the river from Manhattan. I worked in Manhattan a number of times, and I think you saw that in the book. My first job was at CBS News in New York, but I was so happy to move to a place where you actually can't see what you're breathing. And just breathtaking scenery. People were extraordinarily welcoming. And as Michael Perry said in the introduction of the book, and I don't know if you find this because you're from New Hampshire, but he said that 40 years in, this guy is a perpetual newcomer.
Yes. It's the same in New Hampshire.
And it's part of the charm, I think, of being here, because so much of it continues to be new to me, despite the fact that I've traveled the state from Kenosha to Superior and everywhere in between.
And you not only traveled, but you wrote these wonderful little vignettes of people that you met, people you were interested in, and and it was called State of Mind.
Right.
And so the subtitle of this book is Dispatches from a State of Mind. And I think you make the case in a lot of the different people that I met through reading this, that it's not only the physical place, but it is a state of mind. There is a particular Wisconsin ethos or way of viewing the world that is unique to the state.
I think it's absolutely unique to the state. I would even argue that it's probably unique to, it's unique to lots of places between two coasts. My daughter, incidentally, who was my constant nag on the book, kept saying to me, you should call this Between Two Coasts, because while it's about Wisconsin, and it's centered in Wisconsin, it really applies to any place other than New York and L.A. I think it's peculiarly Wisconsin. And if you have just a moment, I think we do, when I was the managing editor of the Milwaukee Journal back in the 80s and 90s, I had a boss named Sig Gisler, who was editor-in-chief and went on to become the head of the Pulitzer Prizes. And I begged him, incidentally, every year to award me a Pulitzer and award the Onion a Pulitzer, too. But
he refused?
He refused, At one point, we actually mounted, we did a video with Tom Hanks and Arianna Huffington and Mario Batali and even Glenn Beck, who wasn't a great fan of the Onion. And we did a video in which people like Hanks would say, I will never pay any respect to the Pulitzer Board again until they award the Pulitzer to the Onion, so richly deserved.
And he was unswayed.
He said, you can come to the award luncheon, but you're not getting a prize.
And you have to pay for your own lunch.
I paid for my own lunch.
Right.
But Sig, when I was the managing editor, we had a story that broke. You know, we covered all of Wisconsin, and we'd get down into northern Illinois and parts of Iowa, and we had a separate edition for the UP of Michigan. But Minnesota was sort of forbidden territory. And a story broke in Minnesota, and it was really interesting, but it was across the state line. And so I think the city editor, or the state editor must have been, came to me and said, we really need to go up there and do that. And I said, but, you know, it's not in our neighborhood, so forget it. And Sig ushered me into his office later and said, I want you to remember one thing, young man from New Jersey. Wisconsin is not just a state. Wisconsin is a state of mind. And that's where the title for my weekly opus came. And also where, you know, a lesson about Wisconsin, that is that certain things that are peculiar to Wisconsin can even happen just beyond the borders.
I was struck by, of course, you talk to a lot of dairy farmers because there are a lot of dairy farmers in
right.
the state. And one of my uncles was a dairy farmer in Rhode Island. And so I was recognizing, even though the accents are different, you know, and the topography might be a little different, I was recognizing that farm humor. Mm-hmm. And I think you captured it so well, that here are these salt-of-the-earth people, but they are not unsophisticated.
No, they're not unsophisticated at all. They had wonderful senses of humor. And I think I actually, well, I'll back up a step. And the step is that when I moved here, I was headed to Los Angeles from New York. I stopped in Chicago. An old friend from college out east was working for the NBC affiliate there. And he had transferred from Colgate University, where I went to school, and he went to Wisconsin because he said, this is in the 70s, and he said, their riots are so much better than our campus riots, and I need to go where there are really decent riots. This is not even respectable here. So I ended up in Chicago, and I was there, allegedly going to be there for one night, and he said, you know, I'm going to marry a woman from Wisconsin. And I said, that's odd. And where is that, incidentally? He said, well, in any event, would you like to meet her? And I said, yeah, it'd be wonderful to meet her. And he said, do you mind if she brings her roommate along? And I said, I don't care if she brings her entire family along. I'm leaving tomorrow, but I'll be really polite. And the roommate, that is my buddy's fiance's roommate, I ended up marrying her. And she was from Madison, Wisconsin. Her father taught at the UW-Madison. And that's how I came up here. It was basically a wrong turn. I was headed east to west, and she made me go north. And I came up here, and I said, I've never seen anything quite so beautiful. And I'd never seen so many farms, of course, in my life, because we just had industrial things in New Jersey for the most part.
Well, at least in the part where you were. There are farms out west as you get closer to Pennsylvania, but you have to go find them.
Very good, yes. If you get out past Morristown, Hackettstown, and you're approaching the Delaware Water Gap, there are some beautiful farms out there. So I would never trash my home state. It was just, let's just say it was entirely different. There's the farm thing I'd return to for a moment. I got out here. I needed a job. I was doing freelance work for the Capital Times and the State Journal in Madison and the Milwaukee Journal, which at that time I'd read an article in Time magazine that said it was one of the 10 best newspapers in America. So I was determined to get a job there. And I did freelancing for probably a couple of years when finally they called me one day and said, we have a job for you. And I was thrilled because in addition to other needs, I was just about broke. And they said, and I thought, well, they're going to have me covering. They'll probably send me to Washington to cover the, you know, the United States Senate, or at least the President of the United States. And they said, we're going to make you the farm editor. And I said, you're going to make me what? I said, I don't know the front end from the back end of a cow. I did work in a supermarket in high school, but that's about the only qualification I have. And they said, well, the Milwaukee audience, for the most part, at least the lion's share of the audience, is urban. And you will have to learn it and then explain it to the urban audience. So I ended up, as the book says, there's a section in there about my farm experiences as the accidental agriculturist.
Yes, and wonderfully rendered, I might say.
Thank you.
And it's like being thrown into the deep end and go ahead, swim.
Yeah.
Do you think you could have written these dispatches now? I mean, the dairy industry has changed. Family farms have changed so much. Could these have been done now?
I think the farming world has always been tough. But, you know, when I first began, which would have been the mid-70s, there were, I want to say, without making an exact count this morning, there were thousands of family farms. And as you know, they're disappearing very, very quickly. And there was a more, I hesitate to say sentimental, but there was a dairy farming family culture that existed then that I'm not so sure exists today. And largely because the business has changed so dramatically, and small farms are not so much places where you raise your family and they're close by. Everybody's working hard to make a buck these days. And not that they weren't working hard, rather, to make money in those days, but there was just a kinder, gentler culture, certainly kinder and gentler than anything I'd been introduced to. And I think, as you may have noticed in the book, at one point, I was ordered by my editor to go out and spend a year, in effect, with a farm. And I found a farm family that would tolerate me. And it was, I have to say, it was probably the greatest year of my life. I just loved it. I got to know the family. I kept in touch with them even afterwards. And I had a wonderful photographer at the Journal named Irv Gebhardt, who was just brilliant. And so we chronicled sort of a year in the life of a family farm. And I think it would be harder to find that farm today.
Did they allow you to milk? Did you ever learn to milk?
But no, I didn't. By the time I got to them, they had gotten out of the milking business. They had been in it for years.
That's right. They were raising heifers. They were raising replacement
heifers.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which I have to say, I didn't even know existed as a business.
Oh, yeah.
Until I read your book.
Yeah, yeah, they bought them for like $200 and sold them for, fed them and then sold them for $650. But they were kind, they were tolerant, and most of all, they were patient. And they taught me a lot from the time they planned in the wintertime till the time they went out and bought their seed and put it in the ground, and it was a wonderful experience. And I just talked to one of the children. She's in the book, actually, who kind of updates me on their family farm. The farm, incidentally, was in Lake Delton, just on the edge of what we know as the Dells. And today, their farm is gone. And her name was Barbara Schultz. And she, when I was talking to her on the phone last summer, she said, take a ride up there and be prepared for a shot to your sentimental side. I went up, and where the old yellow farmhouse stood and where her mother and father had lived for all those years and all the kids were raised and where her mom and dad both died in that house, if you go exactly on that little plot of earth where the house stood, it's a big Hampton Inn today. Surrounded by Culver's and Panera's and Five Guys and everybody's buffet, and the woods that the kids played in is now the Kalahari Resort.
Yeah, I remember as I was reading that chapter thinking, you know, in some ways progress is inevitable and we shouldn't stop it. We have to keep moving.
Yep.
But at the same time, it's sad to lose those touchstones and that part of the past that, you know, you want to bring forward. And I have to say, one of the things that I really loved about the book is that while there is sentiment in it, it's not sentimental. And I didn't feel like you were saying, we have to return to this. You were chronicling something, you were enjoying learning about it, you're sharing it with us, but I didn't feel like there's this gloss of, you know, fuzzy lens looking back. I mean, this was hard work, and, you know, people never had a vacation.
No.
And the animals always
the
came first.
Business.
Yeah, the animals came first, and you don't sugarcoat that. And,
no.
And I have to say, I appreciate that as sort of a tangential, you know, as having my uncle being a dairy farmer, you know, it was bloody hard work, and they never went anywhere.
Yeah, well, you said it better than I could. I mean, they never went anywhere, and they were absolutely wedded to the farms, and they milked them at 4:30 a.m., and they were milking them again at 5 o'clock, and for a farmer to take a vacation was just astonishing. An awful lot of logistics had to be put in place.
Yeah, you had to have somebody come in and take care of those animals the way you would take care of them that you trusted because they couldn't not be milked.
But, you know, one wonderful thing about the farming culture in Wisconsin, to the extent it still exists, and it does exist, just a lot smaller than it used to be. I found that when I was at the Milwaukee Journal, and even at the Onion, because most of the Onion kids, you know, was founded in Madison, and they came from smaller towns in Wisconsin, even the people who worked at the Journal, they were only a generation or two removed from the farm, and they had that same work ethic. That sounds sentimental, but it was absolutely true. If I had a kid who applied and he had gone to Yale, to undergraduate, and Northwestern, to journalism school, and I'm thinking of somebody in particular, and I had a person who grew up on a farm and went to UW Oshkosh and was the first in his family to get a degree, chances are that kid from Oshkosh would outwork the person from the fancy schools. How's that put?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. There is a certain kind of, I don't know, I don't want to call it blue collar because that's not exactly what it is, but there is a certain kind of, when you're working with your hands, you're working with animals, you're working with the seasons, you know, you're working with the land that you actually live on, you do think about things differently. You can't not do it.
Yeah, otherwise you don't make a living and you can't feed your family.
Exactly.
So that was incredibly important. And I just thought those people were just wonderful people.
Well, Steve Hanna, it has been such a pleasure having you on the show. The book is called Dairylandia, Dispatches from a State of Mind. Are you going to be in the Milwaukee area doing any readings?
I have a bunch of invitations. And just because I'm going back and forth from Texas, the next time I'm in Milwaukee is on Saturday. Let me just check this here. Saturday, December 7th at 10 a.m., I'm going to do an event at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. So
that's a great place to do it, too. Have you seen the new museum?
I've been there. It's just gorgeous.
Wonderful.
Gorgeous. And I'm going to be interviewed by a fellow who I worked with when I was at the Journal, a guy named John Torinas. You may know John.
I do.
John was a business editor at the Sentinel, and he's a great patron of the museum, and he's graciously agreed to interview me. So I'm looking forward to that. And I may be back a few other times in December because, Bonnie, you got to move these books.
And I was going to say, I thought you were going to say, well, I got to come up to have snow for Christmas.
Yeah, well, I actually usually do love to have snow for Christmas, but this year is going to be a little more difficult. But thanks so much for reading the book, and I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I really did. Steve Hanna, again, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Steve Hanna is the author of Dairylandia, Dispatches from a State of Mind. Hanna is the former managing editor of the Milwaukee Journal and was a longtime CEO of The Onion. He now divides his time between Wisconsin and Texas, and you can find more information about his book at WUWM.com. Coming up next, poet Greg Shapiro is also influenced by a sense of place. We hear how it can have such a big impact on his work when Like Effect returns in a moment here on WUWM. Like Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Florida-based poet Greg Shapiro had two collections of poems published this year. The first, entitled More Poems About Buildings and Food, is a reflection on the people and places that shaped his formative years in the Midwest. In his second collection of poems, Sunshine State, Shapiro ruminates on both the silly and sublime aspects of his present life in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Shapiro's work as a poet and pop culture journalist focuses on LGBTQ themes, and in 1999, he was inducted into Chicago's Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame. Shapiro was in town recently for a signing at Outward Books on Milwaukee's East Side. Lake Effect contributing producer Lucian Jung met up with him there to talk about his Midwestern roots, the importance of geography on his writing, and his enduring love of storytelling.
First and foremost, accessible is the most important thing. I'm not interested in having people trying to figure out what it is I'm saying. I also write fiction, so I like to also tell stories within my poetry. That's very important, that it maintain, you know, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Well, what came first, prose or poetry?
Poetry came first. Not by much. Like, I was writing fiction as well. My degree from Emerson College in Boston is a BFA in creative writing. So that was my interest, was in writing. But while I was an undergrad, it was definitely all poetry. 25 years after I graduated from college was when my first book of poetry came out.
What kind of subjects did you tackle at that time period in your work?
That book was really, for me, it was sort of like, I wanted it to represent, maybe a really strong representation of me. So the book is separated, the book is called Protection, and it's separated into three sections. A Chicago section, which is where I'm from, a Boston section, which is where I went to college, and a Washington, D.C. section, where I went to grad school. So that represents three very, very important parts of my life. And it's very gay. The content is extremely gay. And that's another representation. But there's family, there's all sorts of other subjects, but there's no question that it's written by someone who's gay.
You know, it can be hard to talk about the experience of being gay. Does poetry make it easier for you to do this?
Actually, I think fiction makes it easier to do it because, for me, the way I write, there's a lot more real experience in poetry. Fiction is made up. You know, it's based on real things.
So you have your narrative work, where it seems like you're working a lot with characters.
Yes.
Is poetry the real Greg?
No. I think there are elements I'm very much in my fiction as well. I think I'm very much in all of it.
Well, the poems that were included in your first book of poetry, Protection, who were you writing those poems for? Were they for you? Or were you? Did you have someone in mind?
I think for me, I'm always writing for someone else. I'm not writing for me. So you know, if I'm writing a poem about an experience, I'm hoping that someone can learn something from it or someone can relate to it. There's a, that there's a commonality, a universal voice. Even if you're straight and you're reading it, I'm hoping that there's something that you can connect to. So I'm always writing for the reader, not for myself.
In your poems, and particularly in the one of the more current books of poetry that was published, More Poems About Buildings and Food, you go to a lot of some really dark places and you tackle some really tough subjects, abuse, drug addiction. Why do you think it's important to go there and explore those tough issues?
Well, again, I think it's something that, you know, everybody probably knows somebody who's had drug issues or some kind of a bad breakup, or there are so many universal experiences, so many things we, I think there's more that we share, more that we have in common than that we don't. I just want to put them into words. I just want to find a way to express that so that we can all, I can connect with other people.
Well, talking about More Poems About Buildings and Food.
Yes.
I mean, you really talk a lot about buildings as a kind of structure that, that people want to escape, but they're very afraid to escape.
One of the things that I would say, maybe even the main thing in both my fiction and my poetry, is my interest in place. Place is really important. As I said, the first book, there's a Chicago section, a Boston section, a Washington, D.C. section. My first book of short stories, Lincoln Avenue, is a collection of short stories. All of it are set in Chicago. So place comes into play in a big way. And in More Poems, place is also a prominent subject. There's actually a poem in the book. The poem is called The City Where I Miss You, which I think most people will get the city that I'm talking about. The poem is set in Boston. But it's really important for me to name streets or neighborhoods or sites. It's really important because I think for me, it helps ground it. As the writer, it helps me see it. It helps ground it in my mind. But I think it also helps ground it for the reader.
Well, and you really do use concrete objects, desks, chrome stools.
Right.
And is that, that's a way to make it sort of real and something that the readers
make it concrete, absolutely. Or,
and also maybe make it real for you?
Well, yes, because I still see when I'm writing, it helps to sort of visualize what I'm writing about. And having these objects in the poems, I think, again, gives it, it's tactile. You can feel it. Sometimes if the there's a poem where I talk about, you know, ordering carryout, and I talk about different kinds of food. Sometimes when I do readings, I write about food a lot, and sometimes when I do readings, I tend to warn the audience, if anybody's hungry, I apologize right off the bat that I'm really sorry, but there's food in it.
Well, a lot of the I don't know if I should call them characters in the poems, they're all very hungry, but they all seem to be trying to deny that they're hungry. There's a suppression
right.
of that.
Oh, absolutely. Especially in More Poems, there are poems about anorexia, about a character, we can call him a character, who was had an eating disorder. Especially as a gay man, there's a lot of gay men with body dysmorphia. It's a long time subject. Gay men, there's a certain ideal body that they're trying to achieve, and I think that is probably reflected in some of the poems about anorexia. That, and also anorexia, in a way, my theory about that is anorexia is a sort of a slow suicide, because ultimately, if you continue to not eat or to deny yourself food, you will eventually die. And I think that that's also, and it's again, I think it's connected to gay male identity and trying to strive for perfection.
What's behind the hunger? Why is everyone so hungry?
Oh, man, I wish I knew. I wish I knew. I wish I could answer that. I think it's, maybe it's a hunger for attention, some of it. Hunger for love and affection. I think that might be some of it.
Well, that, I think, connects into some of the themes in the poems about buildings, because there is this idea of feeling trapped and being so afraid to escape. Mm-hmm. It is this kind of conflict.
It's also, buildings are also safety. I, over the years, have dealt with agoraphobia. So a building is a safe place. It's a safe space. You don't ever have to leave. That's where that comes through, is that having dealt with the fear of leaving the house, going out into the world.
You've lived in so many different parts of the country. How does location inform your voice in your poems?
It's there. I mean, it's in all my work. Like I said before, it's in my short stories. I like naming places. I like naming a bar or a restaurant or a city or a street. Yeah, it's very, very important. Because again, it helps me focus. And I think, sometimes I love when I read a book that set some place where I lived. And I'm like, oh, I know where that is. I know where that place is. I've been there. Or when I watch a movie or something. I always love watching movies that are set in places that I visited, or watching a TV show, because it makes me feel like I'm more familiar with the action, more familiar with the place.
Well, how are the poems that are inspired from your time living in the suburbs of Illinois different than living in South Florida? Your current book is about, you know, Sunshine State.
Yes. Yes, well, I'm definitely a much happier person where I'm living right now. So that might be, I hope that comes through. You know, growing up in Chicago and then moving to the suburbs, I was still a shapeless blob. You know, I was sort of, those are the formative years. And when I look back at that person who sometimes shows up in old poems, or sometimes he'll reappear in new things, and especially in fiction too. Those are the places that formed me, that shaped me, and made me into somebody who wants to live in Florida.
Well, and how are you different? Was that person who lived in Skokie, or were you trying to escape Skokie? Have you spent your entire life trying to escape that?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I have a poem called a very old poem called A Skokie Postcard, about this person who returns home after being away, after living in a big city, and how he just doesn't understand. He can't fit in now, and he doesn't understand how he even was able to fit in before. And the fact of the matter was that I never felt like I fit in there. I graduated from college a semester early. I mean, from high school a semester early, because I wanted to get away from that school, and I wanted to get on with my life and find someplace else to be, someplace else to live.
Well, as much as you've spent so much of your life trying to escape that place, what I pick up in the book of poems about buildings and food is that, you know, you're exploring memory, but it seems as if what you're writing about is very much present for you.
Yes, yes. I'm often playing tag with my memories. It's hard to escape some of this stuff. I mean, I suppose if I went back into therapy, I might find a way to get over some of that stuff. But yeah, my memories, there's no doubt that they inform me. My past informs what makes me who I am.
And does writing help to sort of excise that?
Yes, there is. Yes. There's some, yes, you can kind of get rid of some demons that way. It's a good way to work some of that stuff out. There's the poem that's in Sunshine State called Because of Facebook. It talks about people from the past, you know, who, you know, you might not have been this person's best friend. And I'm talking about people who were bullies, and suddenly they show up again. And it's like, really? Why would you? Part of it is, why would they want to be my friend? And then why would I want to be their friend? But as it turns out, I've reconnected with people and become very good friends with people who might not have been very nice to me when I was in grade school or junior high or high school.
And is it because they've changed, or is it because you've changed?
Wow. Oh, no, I think they've changed. I think I'm the exact same person I was back then. Well, not the exact same, but they've changed.
So when you go back and you read those early poems, you know that person. You recognize that
absolutely
person even now.
Yes. I'm willing to admit that that's me. Yeah. I'm not embarrassed by anything I've written in the past. So yeah, that's very much me. But there's also the me of now that probably wouldn't be here without that other one.
Well, what poem in your current collection of poems in Sunshine State would you not have been able to have written?
Oh, wow.
When you were first writing poetry?
Wow. I don't think there's anything in that book. I don't think there's a single poem in that book that I would have written when I first started. That's a very different voice. And part of it is being in Florida. That has very much influenced my writing. And also just being older. has also influenced it. Because that book really is the newest. I mean, More Poems has a mix of older and newer poems. The older poems aren't the same poems when I first wrote them. These are poems that have been revised countless times. So in my mind, they're new poems, but they also have their origin way in the past. All the poems in Sunshine State were written within the last five years.
But they were all written after you moved.
While I was in Florida.
While you were in
Absolutely.
Florida.
This is my Florida book. I can't deny it. This is very much a Florida book.
Well, I think there's something really hopeful in that, and that you've actually found some place to escape to.
I love it. I'm happy. I have the ocean. I have sunshine. It's green all year round. This is a thing I would have never written about nature in the way that I write about it in Sunshine State, because I didn't feel like I had an experience of nature living in Chicago or living in Boston or living in D.C. Because I have no trouble writing about urban settings like in Chicago or in Boston or D.C. or New York. But it's definitely the geography. It's had a profound effect on my work.
Greg Shapiro is a Florida-based poet, pop culture journalist, and fiction writer. His latest collection of poems is called Sunshine State. Shapiro spoke with Lake Effect contributor Lucian Jung while he was at Outward Books here in Milwaukee. There's more information about him and his work at WUWM.com. We have time for some music today. Singer-songwriter Jesse Malin stopped by the station earlier this week to play some songs and talk about his long career in punk, rock and roll, and Americana. We'll hear his full interview on Lake Effect in the weeks to come, but here is one of the songs he played for us from his newest album, Sunset Kids. It's called Room 13.
Shadows on my wall, in voices in the hall, I'm making up my own scene, hanging out in room 13. I pull down the blackout shade and watch the TV start to fade. Deadbolt on the lock, and I unplug the digital clock. Well, I spent some time in a hotel room thinking about love, and I walked away like those others do. Oh, when it's not enough, the walls are paper thin, in the scene everybody sins. All the liquor stores are closed, and I'm sleeping with the ghost. Well, I spent some time in a hotel room thinking about love, and I walked away like those others do. Oh, when it's not enough, I just wanna do the right thing. But I get dragged down on the wrong side. The girl on the telephone, she asked me when I'm coming home, and I'm falling somewhere in between what she says and what she means. It was something that was said before the phone went dead, like the sound of the falling rain and the rumble of a train. Well, I spent some time in a hotel room thinking about love, and I walked walked away like those others do. On when it's not enough. Thinking about love. Thinking about love.
Jesse Mallon wraps up the show today with his song Room 13. We'll hear his complete in-studio performance for us in the coming weeks. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Bonnie North, Becky Mortensen, and Joy Powers join me in producing Leg Effect each week with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. We also get support from the WUWM News team, including Susan Bentz and Taryn Powell this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reevy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again Saturday and Sunday at 3. That's for Lake Effect Weekend, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.